Next item on the agenda is National Park Service, application number 17-0921. Mr. Eversole, good morning.
National Park Service requests authorization to fill approximately 4.5 acres of state-owned submerged land, to reconstruct and restore approximately 5.45 acres of dike marsh adjacent to the Potomac River and immediately south of the Belhaven Marina by the construction of a riprap breakwater structure, associated stone sills entitled Wetland Creation, as part of the Dike Marsh Wildlife Preserve Marsh Restoration Protection Plan in Fairfax County. The project is protested by several nearby residents, and this proposal has been continued from both your January and February meetings. What I'd like to do is take you through the original application, and then we'll discuss things that have occurred in the last month, which has gotten us to the point where we're here before you today. The project's located in Fairfax County on the western bank of the Potomac River, about 2 miles south of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. This is a fairly recent aerial photo of Dike Marsh, Potomac River to the right of the slide. The Dike Marsh Wildlife Refuge, it pretty much encompasses all of the tidal wetlands shown here. It goes a little further north on the upriver on the slide. This is the George Washington National Parkway. And I'd ask you to take reference of this half-moon-shaped pull-off on the parkway. You'll see that a lot. That's a good reference point right here. This is a 1937 aerial photo of the same area. Here's that pull-off on the parkway. You'll notice this huge landmass that protrudes out into the Potomac River and the extensive marsh system that was here in 1937. Overlaid is the Park Service's application to create these structures. Park Service proposes to construct 5.45 acres of tidal freshwater wetlands within Dike Marsh. The project's the first phase of a plan to reconstruct up to 40 acres of tidal wetlands along the Potomac. The project consists of a riprap breakwater extending from the Fairfax County shoreline approximately 1,500 feet into the Potomac. That's this structure here, which extends out protect Dike Marsh. Slightly upriver from the breakwater, a stone sill is to be constructed. That's this structure here in yellow. That's to be constructed to establish and define the outer edge of a 5.45 acre wetland creation. The project is proposed to be constructed on both state-owned submerged land as well as privately owned submerged land, which resulted from previous mining for sand and gravel. In the early 1930s, Smoot Sand and Gravel Corporation acquired 650 acres of the Dike Marsh. The parcel included the southern 260 acres of Dike Marsh adjacent to what's now the parkway. Between 1940 and 1972, approximately 270 acres of the property were mined for sand and gravel to support the rapid growth in construction in the Northern Virginia area. By the late 1950s, the federal government, local citizens, and various conservation groups began expressing concern that the marsh was degrading due to the mining activities. In 1959, a bill was introduced in Congress to authorize the Secretary of the Interior to acquire the southern portion of Dike Marsh from Smoot Sand and Gravel for the National Park Service. Congress then approved a bill granting the legislation that ensured that a substantial portion of the wetland would remain intact, but they allowed Smoot Sand and Gravel to continue mining in some areas of the marsh. Mining finally ceased in 1972, and the property passed into federal ownership. Congress then enacted legislation in 1974, authorizing the Corps of Engineers to assist the Park Service in planning, designing, and implementing the restoration of the marsh. A joint permit application was submitted in May of 2017 to VMRC. It was distributed to the federal, state, and environmental agencies for their review. The Fairfax County Wetland Board approved their portion of the tidal wetland impacts associated with the project in September of 2017. The Norfolk District Army Corps of Engineers has indicated that it will issue a nationwide permit 27, which I believe they've done in just the past weeks. The Department of Environmental Quality has stated that they will waive their permit requirements for the project if both the Corps and VMRC issue permits. As part of our public interest review, a public notice was placed in the Washington Post. We received two letters of opposition to the project. Mr. Alan Foster, he's a waterfront property owner about a half mile downstream of the project, and he voiced concerns that the project could increase erosion downstream, which could affect the boating public, submerged aquatic vegetation, wildlife, and water quality. A second letter of opposition was received from Ms. Lynn McNeedowitz, a member of a condominium association located upriver just below the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. She questioned the impact of the project on water quality and siltation and asked if the project would have any effect on the floodplain of the Potomac River. Both letters were sent to the Park Service, and in fact, within the last several weeks, the Park Service has responded to those two protestants with letters detailing addressing their concerns, but I've heard from neither, and neither protest has been withdrawn. Letters of support have been submitted from Senators Kane and Warner, Congressman Beyer, Connolly, and McEachin, Virginia Senators Eben, Barker, Favola, Sorrell, and Saslaw, as well as Delegates Hope, Krizik, Levine, Bulova, Corey, and Sickles. In addition, we've received letters from various environmental groups in the area who were interested in providing material from future dredging operations. The dredging material was originally identified in the JPA as a source of the material for the wetland creation, but that has since changed. The marsh is proposed to be constructed on 4.5 acres of submerged land created by the natural erosion of Dyke Marsh from 1974, when mining ceased, to the present. This naturally created submerged land is state-owned submerged land, and as such requires a permit from the commission. Much of the 1,500 linear foot breakwater and a small portion of the created wetland are to be constructed on submerged land that was created by the mining of the sand and gravel. So those areas remain the property of the National Park Service and are not state-owned submerged land. This is an aerial photo of the same area. Here's that pull-off on the parkway. We've just rotated the slide. The blue line represents the 1937 shoreline. You'll see this the large landmass that came out. The green or yellow-green line shows the 1974 shoreline. All the area between the blue line and the green line, we concede, has been mined by smooth sand and gravel. That remains Park Service submerged land.
Mr. Ebersole?
Yes.
Want some water? We got some right here for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Things are starting to bloom.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So the area landward of the 1974 shoreline has naturally eroded over the last 40 years, and that is state-owned submerged land. That's what we're here to for your consideration today. And here's just a blow-up of that area. The area I've highlighted in yellow is state-owned submerged land. You'll see it's just the very first several hundred feet of the breakwater, small little point there. And then the majority of the area that would be wetland created is state-owned submerged land. The Potomac River in the vicinity of the project is host to a diverse submerged aquatic vegetation community. VEMS notes that the SAV was observed in abundance around the D.C. area in the 1900s. By the 1940s, it had completely eradicated from the Potomac River. The region was not inhabited by SAV again until the early 1980s, when hydrilla was observed adjacent to Dyke Marsh, and it has spread up and down the river since then. The Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, in their report for the project, note the importance of hydrilla, a non-native species, in this portion of the Potomac River, noting it provides many of the same ecosystem functions as do native SAV, and in some situations can facilitate recolonization by native SAV species. Both VIMS and DGIF focused their reports on one overarching theme. They both view the project as land reclamation versus marsh restoration. And much of their reports focus on the proposed conversion of SAV beds to tidal wetlands. VIMS notes that up to 15 acres of healthy, dense SAV will be temporarily and or permanently lost to the creation of 5.5 acres of tidal wetlands. The VIMS report states in part, even if marsh construction is successful and eventually matures to an ecologically functional level comparable to the natural marshes, the result will likely be an overall reduction in ecosystem services in the dike marsh wildlife preservation through the disproportional loss of SAV. The DGIF report focuses its attention on, quote, the proposed conversion of SAV beds to tidal marsh and whether that's an appropriate goal. DGIF continues, we cannot be confident that the trade-off between the loss of SAV and the restoration of marsh will result in net ecosystem lift. This is just a plan view of the project submitted by the Park Service. You can see the stone breakwater and the wetland creation sill. I've highlighted in yellow, this is the SAV line shown on the Park Service's application. Everything landward to the west of this yellow line in the Potomac is densely covered with SAV all the way to the shoreline. VIMS and NOAA share a concern that the subtidal mud waves that there could be caused by the creation of these breakwaters and sills, mud waves could result from the installation of the breakwater, thus altering submerged land contours. VIMS questions the structural integrity of the Cobble Beach sills, which are these sills that will make up the contain the wetland creation area. They also noted that there's no access routes built into the sills to allow the movement of aquatic fauna in and out of the created wetlands, and they recommend that the 1,500 linear foot breakwater should be redesigned and repositioned channelward of the SAV line. Chesapeake Bay Foundation submitted comments that they support both the VIMS and NOAA recommendations. Chesapeake Bay Foundation states in their review that they encourage the National Park Service and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to consider alternatives submitted by the Virginia Institute of Marine Science that would protect the existing marsh habitat without undue impacts to the SAV community. They also note that should the commission approve the project, a compensatory mitigation for SAV losses should be required, as well as detailed monitoring plans. This is a blow-up of one of the plan sheets from the Park Service, and it just breaks down the SAV that will be impacted by their proposal. For the stone breakwater, there's a permanent impact to 0.48 acres of SAV and temporary impacts of almost an acre. That's from construction access, barge access, and that kind of thing. For the marsh creation, permanent loss of 6.82 acres of SAV and a temporary impact of 4.5 acres. The 12-foot scar was to impact 0.7 acres, but they have taken that out of the project in an effort to lessen SAV impacts. So, and this is to create the 5.45 acres of marsh. Here's a cross-section of the breakwater structure that would extend out 1,500 feet. It rests on marine mattresses, which are, if you think of mattresses, mattress-shaped structures filled with stone. They'd be placed by crane down on the soft river bottom to provide a foundation for the stone. You would then have a riprap, armor stone cap, and breakwater. This is a cross section of the wetland creation sills. Again, they sit on these marine mattresses for support. Then you have structural stone, and then this is the created wetland area on the landward side, which would then be planted. A meeting was held at the VMRC in January. The meeting was attended by Marine Resources Commission, the National Park Service, the Corps of Engineers, and the park addressed some of the concerns of both VIMS and DGIF. And the results of that meeting were that they decreased the amount of submerged ecologic vegetation that would be impacted. They agreed to incorporate larger stone into the cobble sills. They provided gaps or access routes for the movement of aquatic fauna. They agreed to use only clean masonry washed sand instead of dredge materials for the fill. And they will also look at eliminating topsoil, which they had proposed as part of the planting medium. They will provide a more detailed planting plan. There was some concern over the marine mattresses, and the Park Service conferred with their contractor and the Corps of Engineers, and they're confident that they will not have mud wave impacts, but they're also looking at ways to restore the river bottom should they have some mud waves from those marine mattresses. Park Service is willing to develop a construction staging access plan to help prevent the destruction of SAV on a temporary basis. And they they're willing to share their 3D modeling for the design of the breakwater. VIMS wanted that moved offshore, and the National Park Service's engineers are adamant that it needs to be connected to shore. So they are providing us with their design models, and they're also willing to investigate ways they can compensate for losses of SAV. So they have reached across the table and tried to compromise and come to an agreement. Department of Game and Inland Fisheries also has stated that the Potomac River is confirmed in anadromous fish use area and recommends that should a permit be issued, no in-stream work be conducted between February 15 and June 30 of any year. Finish up with a few aerials. This is the dike marsh area as seen from the Potomac. This PVC pipe here is part of the alignment of the 1,500-foot revetment, so we're at the southern end of the dike marsh area. Moving upriver, you can see the forested portions of dike marsh. This is where the wetland creation is proposed. Moving upriver. Here you can see the dense stands of hydrilla and other SAV species, and they're thick all the way to the shoreline. This was last summer, probably in July or August of last summer, I guess. So our original summary and recommendation: submerged aquatic vegetation is one of the specifically listed environmental factors that the Commission is directed to consider under Section 28.2-1205 of the Code of Virginia when determining whether to grant or deny permit to the use of state-owned bottomland. It's also important to note that the Commission's commitment through the Chesapeake Bay Agreement to restore and increase the abundance of SAV through the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So when evaluating applications for encroachments to state-owned submerged lands, staff carefully evaluates the need to impact SAV. Although the restoration of the tidal wetlands is a laudable goal, we cannot support the permanent loss of up to 7.3 of acres, permanent loss and temporary loss of 12.7 acres of SAV for the creation of 5.45 acres of tidal wetland. As an alternative, we recommend minimizing the project scope and footprint and concentrating efforts to protect the remaining marsh and to relocate the breakwater channelward of the existing SAV. Should the Commission choose to approve the project as proposed, staff recommends the following special conditions: the imposition of a time of year restriction preventing in-stream work between February 15 and June 30 of any year, the receipt of revised plans showing the offered modifications, including the deletion of the proposed filling of the deep scar area the incorporation of larger stone in the Cobble Beach sills, and the creation of gaps or access routes to allow for the free movement of aquatic fauna, the use of clean fill sand composed of no less than 90% sand, the development of a plan to restore the contours of any state-owned submerged land to its original contours should mud waves result from the construction of the project, and the submittal of a plan for review and approval by VMRC staff to compensate for the loss of submerged aquatic vegetation attributed to the project. And that plan could consist of replanting SAV, contributions to ongoing efforts supporting SAV restoration, combination of the two, or any other strategy acceptable to VMRC staff. Now, in the past month, since this was continued at your February hearing, at the request of the Secretary of Natural Resources, a meeting was held on March 9th to develop a strategy to move the project forward. In attendance were representatives of the Secretary's Office, the Marine Resources Commission, the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, the National Park Service, and the Baltimore District of the Army Corps of Engineers. At that meeting, an alternative plan was identified that reduced submerged aquatic vegetation impacts while scaling back the footprint of the wetland creation portion of the project. The alternative would still allow for the stabilization of dike marsh as well as the construction of emergent tidal wetlands. The plan consists of locating the revised wetland creation boundary at half the distance to the narrowest proposed offshore boundary, beginning at the northern terminus of the wetland creation and extending to the south to terminate at the southern natural shoreline of the same wetland creation area. So what we're talking about is we would move this sill structure in half the distance from this point of the proposed sill. So the alignment of the sill would come in this general vicinity. It would come down, cut across here, and tie back in. The portion of the project is intended to create a linear marsh fringe along the forested wetland shoreline, and it would extend approximately 100 feet offshore channelward into the SAV. This plan would result in an estimated 1.2 acres of SAV that would be lost by the creation of the wetland. While the National Park Service has not committed to this plan yet, staff finds the size and scope of this compromise appropriate for the area, and we can support this conceptual design. Also, due to the reduced scope of the wetland creation resulting from this compromise, the Park Service should have additional funds remaining to construct additional shoreline stabilization further up the marsh, protecting more of dike marsh in its existing location. And also to create a living shoreline immediately north of the landward terminus of the breakwater. They could create a living shoreline in this area here that would protect the George Washington National Parkway. Both of these additional structures, which staff believes are warranted, would require the submission of a joint permit application, tidal wetland permit from the Fairfax County Wetland Board, and consideration by the Commission. The National Park Service also seeks approval to construct the 1,500 linear foot riprap breakwater structure. The initial 600 to 700 feet of the breakwater to be constructed on dense beds of SAV, resulting in the permanent loss of almost a half acre and the temporary losses of almost an acre of SAV. Both VMRC and VIMS staff have recommended to the Park Service that the breakwater begin channelward of the SAV. VIMS shoreline scientists do not consider it necessary for the breakwater to connect upland. The National Park Service and the Corps of Engineers design engineers are equally confident that in their design modeling and deem it imperative that the structure tie into the upland. Given the differing perspectives from technical experts, VMRC staff cannot recommend approval or denial of the breakwater structure. We understand, though, as explained by the National Park Service, that the project proposal should be considered as a whole because removal or redesign of the breakwater will result in contracting limitations and the loss of federal funding. If the marsh creation is approved as proposed by the Park Service, we understand the Office of the Secretary of Natural Resources and the NPF and the National Park Service have discussed an offering of $400,000 by the Park Service to support a collaborative effort between the National Park Service, VMRC, and VIMS to support SAV management, also monitoring research and restoration. If the alternate alignment noted is approved, staff believes that funding support to address the loss of SAV should be offered in an amount of $2 per square foot for SAV impacts based on the final design of the project. At this time, we estimate that the loss of SAV from the alternate design would be approximately 1.7 acres, and we also would feel that this funding proposal by the Park Service as a collaborative partnership between the Park Service, VMRC staff, and VIMS to support SAV management, including further research, monitoring, and replanting efforts within the Potomac River and the greater Chesapeake Bay watershed. We'd further recommend that the Park Service consider sites for planting adjacent to Park Service properties within the Bay watershed or provide opportunities in their park facilities for educational presentations or workshops on the benefits of SAV. Should the Commission choose to approve the proposed plan or the alternative project, staff recommends that the proposed permit conditions outlined in our February 27th evaluation be incorporated. If the alternative project is approved, staff recommends that the Commission require the submission of detailed drawings for the redesigned wetland creation area. In addition, a plan for the use of any collaborative funding should be provided for review and approval by the Commission staff prior to any construction of the wetland creation project. If approved, a permit can be issued immediately for the portion of the 1,500 linear foot riprap breakwater that's on state-owned submerged land, and construction can proceed on that while the revised wetland creation and the funding plans are being developed. This would allow the project to move forward and avoid the potential loss of the critical federal funding that the Dyke Marsh has acquired. Be glad to answer any questions you have. I know I threw a lot at you. Doug Jacobs and Tom McCloskey from the Park Service are here, and they also have a presentation that may clear up anything that I've left unsaid.
Any questions by members of the commission? Ms. Everett?
So the current proposal in front of us is 15 acres of temporary and permanent loss, 7.3 permanent?
Correct.
And what is the temporary time frame? Or is that hard to say? 5 years? No, I'm sorry. Maybe this is a question for VIMS. What would the temporary time scale be for loss of SAV? 6 months?
Let's let VIMS answer that one if we would. Yeah, I think so. They're here. Well, I think now what's fresh, if you would, just address that issue right now, and then we'll have further. But if you would do that to whoever's going to do it. Want to keep it flowing and fresh in your mind. For the record, state your name, please, sir.
Rob Arnell, VIMS, Commissioner Bowman, and Ms. Everett, if you don't mind, can I preface this a little bit to set the stage for how we could be more interactive today?
Sure.
And such. The reason being is we feel you've got a very thorough and more substantive than normal science-based report from us. And projects that are this scale and this complex, we generally get more people involved at VIMS than is normal that you see in a report, and that's what we did this time. We had up to 20 people involved at VIMS based on expertise and experience, and we have certain ones of those here today that you can ask direct questions to and could maybe help give you some more detail in that helped in the report. And a little bit about each one of those, you may have noticed them when they stood up for their to be sworn in. Other than Mark and myself here, we have Dr. Troy Tuckey. You've seen Troy up in front of you a few times recently. Dr. Tuckey's with our Department of Fisheries Science. He's been with us about 10 years now. Runs our juvenile trawl survey, juvenile striped bass survey, eel survey. His specialty is anatomous fish, fisheries habitat, freshwater areas among the general fisheries ecology. We also have Dr. Jim Perry. Dr. Perry is now emeritus. He spent his entire career at VIMS. He's a specialist in tidal freshwater wetlands. He helped pioneer in Virginia tidal and non-tidal compensatory mitigation, restoration, and creation. One thing about Jim is his experience and how much he's respected. He served as the 2014-2015 president of the International Society of Wetland Scientists, and he's still in his retirement serving that role in some way. We also have Dr. Bob Orth. You know Dr. Orth very well from past times in front of you. We'll expound on much, except recently Dr. Orth was honored by the governor of North as an outstanding scientist of Virginia. And you may have seen in the paper this morning, one of his recent studies has gotten a lot of traction, was actually honored in front of the National Press Club. We also have Mr. Scott Hardaway with our Shoreline Studies program. You may have seen Scott a few times over the years. Scott has been over his around 35-year experience plus at VIMS, has monitored shoreline stabilization, was involved in the development of such structures and approaches, studied shoreline evolution and erosion. And recently Scott was, because of his experience and expertise, was approached by the National Academy of Sciences, National Science Foundation, to be an author on their seminal book on how to address erosion in estuaries, mitigating shore erosion along sheltered coasts is the book of that. And we also, I think, have Dr. Ken Moore. Ken's been at VIMS about 45 years. He's worked with Dr. Worth over many years with SAB. He's also a specialist in water quality. Ken, like many of us, helped with the Bay Program develop the water quality standards that went into effect in Virginia in 2005, whereas SAB is an element of the water quality standards in Virginia as a surrogate to water clarity. So with that, we can answer your questions. We have this cadre of people here that could probably answer them more substantively, so however you would like to proceed with that.
Ms. Everett, would you restate the question, please, for Mr. Varnell?
Sure. The temporary loss of SAV, I guess, by 15 acres total, 7.3, I think I remember, would be the permanent. How temporary would that loss be? Is that 6 months or 3 years or 10 years?
Address some of this, but I will say that's greatly dependent upon how the construction goes and sequences from that perspective. So I don't think we can really give you a specific time.
Yeah, Mr. Varnell basically said exactly what I was going to say. We will not have any idea how quickly the recovery will be unless we know what kind of perturbation occurs to the bottom that they're calling disturbed. We do know that the area is occupied and surrounded by a lot of existing SAV, so there are lots of propagules floating around. So if the disturbance is minimal, it could be as short as a couple years. If the disturbance is major, where a construction barge sits on the bottom could be disturbed pretty radically. And even with propagules, they may not reestablish for perhaps a decade or more. We don't know. So there's a big unknown in that component.
Follow up, Ms. Everett.
So also related to SAV, the 1.2 acres of potential SAV have impact from the March 9th discussion, March 9th proposal, or maybe it's 1.7, including the breakwater.
I think it's 1.7.
1.7, okay.
Total.
Is that total impact permanent? Is there also temporary as well? Is it hard to say because that is such
that's
a new
permanent problem? That's the permanent loss. And there are some numbers going back and forth, the exact number when you go 1.7, 1.78. But I think what the proposal, as you were highlighted, is permanent loss in that area.
Okay.
So the permanent loss depends on exactly what you approve here.
7.3 versus 4.7, I believe, is the actual total amount based on proposals.
The initial 7.3 of the original proposal.
Correct.
Versus 4.7.
Versus 1.7. Yes, ma'am. Is that correct, Donnie? Thank you. Further questions on this end? Mr. Ballard?
It's more a question for staff, if that's appropriate.
It is, absolutely. Mr. Eversole.
I believe I heard you mention we have a 1,500-foot breakwater, but on state-owned submerged bottomlands, it's only a small portion.
Only the first 200 to 300 feet.
Why are we not considering the entire 1,500 feet state-owned submerged bottomland? It looked like it was below mean low water.
If you go back to that, Most of the breakwater is to be built on submerged land that was upland and was mined for sand and gravel. So when that land still belongs to the National Park Service now. Much the same if you made a man-made canal, that would not be state-owned submerged land. That would be privately owned or a lake.
Further, Mr. Ballard?
The $2 per square foot that I saw is mitigation for the SAV impacts. Is that a standard measure? How did we determine that?
Tony, would you like to address that?
I'll address that.
Mr. Watkinson?
We have included that as a proposed amount for square footage if it gets down to basin on what gets accrued. Recently, we have dealt with smaller shoreline stabilization projects. That were breakwaters, maybe a shoreline project, and we tried to identify a means by which to compensate for the SAV that was being lost. And in those instances, the best compensation we could come up with was supporting the seeding operation that's occurring in the lower bay that VIMS operates. And it was concluded that if they contributed about $2 per square foot to the area they impacted, they could produce a seeding amount that offset the losses. So $2 per square foot for the amount of impact is what we utilized. And those projects previously were in the hundreds to thousand square foot range for the compensation that they would provide for SAV losses. So in this case, we thought that we could use that same number if the commission permitted a reduced plan, the alternative plan, based on the final drawings, we would know what the ultimate impact would be, and then we could ask the Park Service to contribute and help fund a plan with us to restore or manage SAV at a rate equal to $2 per square foot for what was being lost.
But
so that's where that $2 came from.
And if I'm at
other similar projects, well, small projects that we've dealt with recently.
And if I may follow up, the discussions that the Secretary had at the meeting pertaining to the cooperative agreement with the $400,000 to contribute toward the cooperative effort, would take care of the $2 per square foot and more. So it wouldn't be both as it's in it. Does that make sure it's clear?
The $400,000 would likely be more than the amount of $2 per square foot based on the alternative plan.
And their desire to be involved in a cooperative project to for SAV restoration. Mr. France.
Yes. My question was, I know that hydro seems to be the main SAV here, but are we talking about any native SAVs? Are they starting to return? I know they have been gone in this area.
I'd like to have Dr. Orth. Dr. Orth?
Sure. What has been interesting following the development of hydrilla in the Potomac River, if you go back to when there was no SAV in the river in the 70s, in the early 80s, apparently hydrilla was reintroduced mistakenly. Someone thought it was Elodea, so it was planted, and hydrilla took over, rapidly spread. So initially it was dominated by hydrilla, but what we've seen and reports have shown that there's a mix of many native species that now occur. Now, this is not real recent data because we don't have people out there every day. What we provide is the aerial coverage, but we have data that I can show you if you want, 2001 from Dr. Nancy Rabicki from USGS that shows that when you look at the cover, total cover, which is what you saw in the pictures, that cover is made up of 4 to 5 or 6 different species, some of which are native. And in many cases, the cover of 100% is not just hydrilla, it's other species. So what hydrilla has done is created an environment that allowed many of these native species that had not been seen since the early 1900s to recolonize. So it's created a neat environment. So it's not just dominated by one species, it's there are many others.
Okay, further questions? Dr. Worth, I have one.
Yes.
Going back to the old days pertaining to hydrilla.
Yes.
Hydrilla was a non-native invasive species that at times we actually issued permits, as I recall, to actually chop hydrilla and use it for different things. Just to the point now, I think I found a term in here called a pioneer species.
That's correct.
Explain to me the difference between the perception of hydrilla some 10 or 15 years ago versus what your professional perception of hydrilla is as it relates to the environment that we're talking about.
If you were a lake owner or a reservoir manager, you'd be really concerned about the spread of hydrilla. However, in estuaries, if you look at what happened with hydrilla, considered an invasive, as we have several other invasives in the bay, it acts primarily like a regular native SAV. It colonizes very rapidly, spreads because the plants break off and move around. You know, we now have hydrilla really throughout the Chesapeake Bay, so the initial colonization of a pioneer species, which was, again, accidentally introduced in the early 80s, we now have hydrilla throughout the bay, and it's a mainstay of the bay community. The you know, in Virginia, the Pamunkey and Mattapani are dominated by hydrilla. We have the Chickahominy. So it's providing the conditions for the recovery of lots of our natural species. So while it may be considered invasive and a problem in some areas in the Chesapeake Bay, I think right now people's perceptions are it's better than having nothing. There are permits to cut, and as we see from our aerial imagery, a lot of people will get permits to cut through hydrilla to get to their boat moorings or whatever. So it does occur. We see that happening throughout the bay. But again, what we see are many of the benefits that occur because of the fact that it just acts like a normal SAV species. I don't know whether that answers your question or
not. It does. I just wanted to make sure
it's been interesting. When hydrilla was first introduced, there was a concerted effort to perhaps eliminate every plant, and the core was there, and everyone said, well, wait, let's just stop and not worry about what you can do to get rid of it. And, of course, the decision was let's let it roll. There were many people that were initially opposed to it, many of them people who lived by the river, some of the watermen. And now some of those people really see benefits. As a matter of fact, when we see our imagery, you see all these boats lined up along the edges of the hydrilla beds because that's where the big fish are going. You know, the big fish are foraging along the edges for the little fish that occur within the bed. So the people are making some money, obviously guiding people around these submerged beds.
Okay. Any follow-up to Ms. Everett first, then Mr. Ballard.
Sure, and this is a follow-up about the mitigation funds for SAV.
Yes.
Is it typical to be able to replicate or to do restoration for tidal fresh SAV?
That's an excellent question, and we were anticipating that because there are no good cases in the bay of large-scale or even small-scale restoration of freshwater plants. I will say that when they built the new 295 Woodrow Wilson Bridge, there was an amount of money paid to mitigate the loss of that, and because they realized it would be impossible to mitigate freshwater plants, they moved the mitigation to the mouth of the Potomac down by St. George Island on the Maryland side. And they actually mitigated with seagrass species, eelgrass, which is what we use. And that whole operation started and basically failed. That is, all the money that was put into mitigation for the loss of the SAV from the bridge down to the mouth of the river was not successful. But yeah, to answer your question, though, there's been no really good success. Dr. Moore has done quite a bit of restoration in the James River. And unfortunately, the efforts there have not had long-term success because we have some issues called herbivory. There are some species out there that like to eat the grass. There are some natural areas that are coming back and doing well, like the Chickahominy. There's some significant beds. But again, actual mitigation for the loss of freshwater species is problematic today.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Mr. Ballard?
When we've had SAV conflicts in the past, you've often categorized the amount of SAV in a 0 to 10%, 10 to 20% kind of strata. How would you categorize this area?
Four. Absolutely four. There's 100% cover of that entire shoreline.
Okay.
And what was interesting, there was, just to give you a little perspective too, when they built the bridge, there was significant loss from the construction activities, and many of the beds in the middle part of the river disappeared, and they've been coming back pretty rapidly. And again, most of the beds in that river are the highest classification that we can give this to, and it happens very rapidly.
Further questions?
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Ms. Everett.
I have one further question. I think it's for Mr. Eversole, potentially. you had mentioned that this would allow, the project discussed on March 9th would allow for more protection along broader portions of the shoreline than originally, because there would be additional funds left over if they're redesigned. How much more is it you can do? 25% more shoreline, or is there a linear footage?
That's,
or is
hard
it hard
to say now because we don't have the final design of the of a compromise plan, so we don't know. We estimate there would be funds left over, and we can identify areas that we think would be the next move for the Park Service to stabilize, but it's hard to say how much linear footage wise.
Thanks. Questions? Dr. Neal.
I guess my question is a clarification of what staff recommendation is. I mean, what I'm hearing is that we're recommending that we deny this permit, but we approve some lesser plan that we really don't know what it is yet. And so I guess my question is a procedural thing. I mean, are we going to just approve this lesser project that hasn't really been proposed yet, but y'all discussed it, but we don't have it? Or are you asking us just to deny this permit and this new proposal will come before us again later?
No, sir, we're recommending approval of the modified plan that came from the March 9th meeting of the reduced footprint that extends about 100 feet channelward of the shore. There are no design plans for that yet, so what we would anticipate, should the commission approve that, is allowing the Park Service to begin construction on the 1,500 linear foot revetment, and then we would receive plans, modified plans from the Park Service for the staff could review and approve, if necessary, bring back to the commission if we felt you needed to see it. But that would allow the Park Service to begin work on their revetment, allow them time to revise plans for the lesser footprint modified wetland creation.
I think that pretty much clears up.
Okay.
It's kind of a little bit of an odd
point. What we will do, Dr. Neal, Mr. Watkinson, is prior to conclusion, you will have specifics as far as the staff recommendation is concerned as to what's there. This is kind of a work in progress as we go along, as you'll hear, likely from the Park Service. So at the end, there will be specific points that you will be able to be in a position to vote on.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Mark. Is the applicant present or represented?
Yes.
Good morning, sir. Sir, have you been previously sworn?
No, I have not.
Would you raise your right hand?
Yes.
You solemnly swear the testimony which you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Doug Jacobs. I am the Deputy Associate Regional Director for Facilities, Design, and Construction for the National Park Service, the National Capital Region.
Pleasure to have you here, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I wish you a good morning, Commissioner Bowman, fellow commissioners. I'm actually very pleased to be here today. We were intended to be here in January, and the government shutdown kept us away. And, of course, if you were following the news.
It was close.
Friday.
It was close.
We're going to be here today.
Well, we're glad you are here.
Thank you. So, we are here to talk about the Dyke-Meyers Wildlife Restoration. The Dyke-Meyers Wildlife Preserve Restoration is a very important project to the National Park Service as well as to the local community. The project has a congressional mandate. It is supported by public money. And it has broad support of the elected officials from the federal, state, and local level. From our point of view, it is a feel-good project. It is saving a rapidly disappearing tidal freshwater resource, and it is the culmination of years and years of advocacy. There has been considerable engineering that has gone into the project. We developed an EIS. That EIS outlined a preferred alternative that looked at both stabilizing the marsh and restoring it. But we recognize that there are concerns. Obviously, you just heard some of those concerns. There are concerns about some of the details proposed in the project, but largely the concerns are about the impacts to SAV. We have listened very, very carefully and taken those concerns very seriously. We have done our best to try to address some of the details that have been discussed, and we're going to pull those in as design refinements into the project. But we feel very strongly that the ecological value that comes along with restoring freshwater tidal marsh far outweighs the impacts to the SAV. So what I also wanted to make a strong point about today is that we are really at the point of no return, that the funding for this project is at risk. We really must move forward with the project as designed. We do not have the luxury to redesign. And restoration, the preservation of the marsh is part and parcel with the restoration. So the as Mark alluded to, the project site is in just south of Alexandria. It is along the Potomac River, next to the very scenic George Washington Memorial Parkway. It is a physical buffer between the river and the George Washington Memorial Parkway and the populated areas immediately to the west. It is also a really important green space to the local community, which is particularly scarce in this dense metropolitan region. The National Park Service estimates that 438,000 visitors use the trails through Dyke Marsh each year. It is very popular for walking, for jogging, for biking. It is a very popular destination for bird watching. It is popular for paddling and for sailing. There is a Bell Harbor Marina, is a very popular marina that is just to the north of the limits of the marsh. It is also an outdoor classroom. It is used by many, many school groups, many youth programs and community organizations. The Dyke Marsh Wildlife Preservation is a very special place. It was recognized as such in 2009 by the Congress, who identified Dyke Marsh Preserve as a unique and precious precious ecosystem. And that was reaffirmed in 2016 by the Virginia General Assembly, who identified Dyke Marsh as a valuable natural resource and supported its restoration. The Dyke Marsh Wildlife Preservation is one of the last remaining tidal freshwater marshes in the upper Potomac. There is a reason that we call it a wildlife preserve. It supports 239 species of migratory and resident birds. It is also includes three state rare species, including the marsh wren, the least bittern, and the swamp sparrow. There are more than 300 plant species, including rare state species such as the river bulrush, the Davis sedge, and the rough havens. There are 34 species of mammals, 38 species of fish, 30 species of reptiles and amphibians, and more than 6,000 species of arthropods. And as you can see from that photograph there in the center, it also has a really great bug hotel. So Dyke Marsh really gained a lot of notoriety after the construction of the parkway in 1932. People suddenly became aware of it, became aware of its beauty, of the special resources there. And in 1947, respected naturalist Lewis Hall described Dyke Marsh as being the nearest thing to a primeval wilderness in the immediate vicinity of the city. And so with that growing popularity and appreciation, in 1959, Congress acquired Dyke Marsh as an irreplaceable wetlands for the production and preservation of wildlife, and went on to say that they wanted it to be managed so that fish and wildlife development and their preservation as wetland wildlife habitat shall be paramount. But unfortunately, dredging rights were still given to the Smoot Sand and Gravel Corporation, and they continued dredging there until 1973. And during that time, outrage arose over the loss of the wetlands, and it spurred a lot of activism. So in 1974, after the dredging operations had ceased, Public Law 93-251 was passed by the Congress, which authorized the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to assist the National Park Service in restoring the marsh by providing fill and material and technical expertise. This is a local newspaper article from that time, which talked about how the Interior Department was going to work with the Corps of Engineers to restore 1.5 miles of marshland that had been destroyed by the dredging. Talked about how the engineers were going to build 1.5 miles of dikes that they were going to then fill with spoils in order to be able to bring back the muskrats and ducks and other wildlife to be able to use the area. And it went on to say that the House Public Works Committee was enthusiastic over the idea of restoring valuable habitat for fish and wildlife. So despite a lot of continued studies and activism, really the project didn't pick up a lot of steam until 2007. In 2007, the Water Resources Development Act, WRDA, was passed, which said that the Secretary of the Army should accept funds from the National Park Service in order to restore Dyke Marsh. And in 2008, the Park Service was fortunate enough to receive a grant, an $800,000 grant, which allowed us to enter into an interagency agreement with the United States Army Corps of Engineers to begin an environmental impact study and long-term management plan. The EIS drew heavily on a report being conducted by the USGS that was published in 2010. The report was significant in that it dated the marsh as approximately 2,000 years old, and it determined that the storm waves driven northward up the Potomac were really the predominant cause of erosion, and it pointed out the historic promontory, which you see there circled with the oval in red on the first image, had really been the element of protection that had protected the marsh for some 2,000 years. But alarmingly, it also concluded that at the current rate of erosion without that promontory, the marsh was going to be gone by 2035. So the environmental impact statement, the study, developed a preferred alternative based upon restoration. It called for the restoration of the historic promontory. It called for restoration of the marsh itself, the idea being that containment cells would be set up and dredge spoils would be collected from the Army Corps of Engineers. Phase one, we would build as many as 40 acres, and those 40 acres are identified in the bright green color. And it also called for the future phases of up to 150 acres more to be restored over time, and those, of course, are the lighter green. In 2013, we were very fortunate in on the anniversary of Superstorm Hurricane Sandy, the Dyke-Marsh Wildlife Preserve restoration was awarded $24.9 million to begin implementation of Phase 1. This was the largest of 31 resiliency projects awarded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the projects that were selected out of those 31 projects were projects that primarily selected to restore coastal marshlands, wetlands, and shoreline, to create open connections to rivers and streams for fish passage, and to reduce the risk of flooding from future storms. Not long after, we began design and engineering, and we ran into several pretty big obstacles. As it turned out, there were not any dredging operations that the Corps was doing anywhere in the vicinity, and so there was not any dredge material available to us. Looking even further, there weren't any dredging projects funded for many, many years. In addition, the photograph there is of a barge that was brought out to do dilatometer testing, which is basically taking core samples of the bottom of the river. And what they found was that barge wasn't big enough. Those shafts were not long enough. We had to bring in a much bigger barge in order to be able to find the bottom of the river. And I remember as we were going through the results of this study, one of the engineers kind of just shaking his head and saying, there's no bottom, there's just 20 feet of muck. So as a result of that, much more robust foundations were required, much more fill was required. And of course, none of that fill was free. So the project had to be considered, had to be scaled down considerably in order to be within available funds. And so we had to reduce the project from what we had envisioned had been 40 acres of restoration down to only 5.45 acres. And so we get into the freshwater tidal wetlands versus SAV, and I feel at a real loss because I was not intending to debate the science of this, and I did not bring my scientists here to talk and to answer specifically some of the points raised by BIMS. But I will say that the Park Service has been consistently surprised by the opposition to the project because of its impact to SAV, particularly since the SAV in question is hydrilla, which is an invasive species, which is still listed on the USDA's list of federally noxious weeds. And although I have to say that through this process, I have come to appreciate hydrilla much, much more, and to understand the benefits that it has in terms of water quality and fish habitat, I think everybody here has to agree that, those benefits are limited to water quality, to the aquatic, that they do not provide any benefits to the plant and animal species on the land. And it does, and from the studies that I have seen, it does not provide the biodiversity of the tidal freshwater marshes. And we also have scientists of our own that have really studied Dyke Marsh specifically and have pointed out that, really the SAV, the hydrilla that is there, unlike in other areas, does not show evidence of supporting other native species. It seems to be choking them out. And of course, from our perspective, you know, this project is intended to restore tidal freshwater marsh, which is a very scarce resource. It's rapidly, disappearing. And of course, hydrilla in the bay is very abundant. Some of the concerns that were raised about the project were, what about its success? We have an ecosystem of SAV that's doing just fine. What if we go forward with this project and it's not successful? Well, to that, the Park Service says, we're dedicated to the success of this project. We have done our best. We have selected a contractor who has a long list of experience of successful wetland projects. We also have a monitoring and maintenance plan that was developed in the EIS. We also have $950,000 set aside in the conservation fund that is specifically for the monitoring, the maintenance, and the preservation of the marsh. And although that may not sound impressive to you, from the Park Service's point of view, where we estimate that we have $12 billion worth of deferred maintenance across the service in our 420 parks, the idea of having $950,000 specifically for the maintenance of this important resource, that's really unheard of in our perspective. Not only, and of course we have an engaged local community, not only will we employ the experts through the Conservation Fund to help us maintain the marsh, but we're planning on using youth corps and volunteers to really encourage learning and environmental stewardship, promote a sense of ownership of the marsh. There have been a number of alternative designs suggested. One of them you heard just a little bit ago about getting rid of the restoration and going with a living shoreline instead. And to that, the problem is simply that that doesn't meet the purpose of the project. The Congress has told us to restore the marsh. The grant that we received was for the restoration of the marsh. And just putting in a living shoreline was not analyzed in the EIS. One of the other suggestions was moving the breakwater riverward so that we would avoid some of the SAV. These are a couple of images from the computer modeling that was done. The Army Corps of Engineers tells us that that really will not provide the protection that is needed for the marsh. And being that they are the engineers of records and the fact that they won't certify the project with that change, we're reluctant to move forward in that direction. Compounding that problem is making such a change to the promontory would be considered a cardinal change. From the federal acquisition regulations point of view, anytime you make a significant change to the scope of a project that has already been awarded, you have to throw that project out and you have to recompete it because there might have been others that would have been interested in bidding on that project if they had known, you know, what these new conditions were. If the project is thrown out, the money that we have for the project is at risk. So then there's this discussion about a reduced footprint, and in fact, the Park Service has met with the staff from DMRC. We also had a meeting on March 9th at the governor's office with DMRC and with VIMS, and we did go into that trying to brainstorm on a way to reduce the impacts to SAV. What we came up with was a proposal to reduce the amount of marsh restoration and create just a narrow strip of it along the wooded wetland area. And although that made sense at the time, when we went back and recalculated the numbers, it really only amounted to about an acre and a half of marsh restoration. And again, we just don't feel that that meets the project purpose. A scope change that big would probably need to go back to the Congress to be able to approve that change. The other problem that we have with this is that it does not recognize the ecological lift that the nationwide 27 permit is based upon. The nationwide 27 permit says that that restoration is required from us in order to compensate, to mitigate for the impacts of the SAV. So that would put us out into a situation where we would have to go through the permitting exercise again. And of course, it just doesn't pass the red face test. To be perfectly honest, our faces are already a little pink. We've gone from a situation where we proposed to preserve 40 acres. We're down to 5.45. We just don't feel like we can go forward with a restoration project that spent $25 million on and would only get 1.5 acres. And again, the idea that leftover money could be used for other parts of the project, it really can't. That money is expiring, and so it would not be available to us for some of those other projects. So it's not all bad. A lot of the comments that we received during the review actually made a lot of sense. We think that we can incorporate a lot of those, and we think that the project will be better for that. It was mentioned that there is a deep scar adjacent to the restoration area that was planning on being filled We don't necessarily need to fill that. That will reduce the impacts to the SAV by about 0.7 acres. Concerns have been raised about the dredge material for fill, and of course we're not doing that any longer. There are also concerns about bringing in topsoil in order to help establish the plants more quickly. We've agreed not to use topsoil. We will use just clean sand, which meets all the Virginia standards for cleanliness. The plants that we will plant will be already fertilized before they go in. In talking with the contractor, we think that that they will still be very successful, that they will still thrive. We will definitely monitor for any mud waves. We don't expect them to happen because of the construction method. We're using a crane off of a barge to lower in marine mattresses that then are set in very carefully and then filled with rubble stone. And as part of that process, usually mud waves don't occur, but we will watch for that. And if they do occur, we will regrade to make sure that we are restoring the contours of the river. One of the best ideas we thought was incorporating these ingress and egress channels through the sill of the restoration area to be able to exchange encourage freer exchange of water, fish, and aquatic fauna in and out through the restoration area and the river. Even though the native species in the marsh are primarily narrow-leaved cattails, we are absolutely open to planting a wider variety of native plant species. We'll incorporate that into our planting plan. And absolutely, as we develop the staging plans with our contractor, we are happy to share those with the commission staff and try to get their feedback and see if they have any suggestions on how to lessen the impacts to SAV. As I mentioned, we really are at a crossroads here. The funding is at risk. It's been 5.5 years since Hurricane Sandy, and if the contract that we have on the table is not awarded, the money may evaporate. The contract that we have on the table, we awarded at the very end of last fiscal year. It was awarded actually on September 30th, a Saturday of 2017. We have had to extend that contract, push the notice to proceed out as we've gone through this permitting process. And we're being told by the contracting office at the Army Corps of Engineers that we really just can't continue to extend that any further. That unless we issue a notice to proceed in the next few days, they are telling us that we're going to need to terminate that contract. And again, the money with that will likely disappear. So stabilization, unfortunately, cannot be separated out from the restoration project that we have here. As I mentioned, to do that, that's a huge change to the scope, to what Congress told us to do. And we feel as though we would have to go back for congressional approval. The federal acquisition regulations would consider it a cardinal change, so therefore we would have to throw out that contract and recompete. We probably wouldn't have the money to recompete a new project. And of course, as I mentioned, the Nationwide 27 permit requires restoration as mitigation, so we would have to go through that permitting process again. Nonetheless, although we may be approaching this from slightly different perspectives, the Park Service, like VMRC, has common goals. We are absolutely committed to preserving the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay. And irregardless of the outcome today, we have pledged to work together on a collaborative agreement to work with VMRC to either establish projects to monitor and maintain and perhaps even plant underwater seagrasses in other locations, or if that is not feasible, we're willing to work with them to be able to fund some additional studies that they could do that would help advance the understanding and of the importance of underwater seagrass to the health of the bay. because the funding is at risk, this is likely the last opportunity we have to save Dyke Marsh for future generations. And in summary, I'd just like to say that we recognize how challenging this must be for the Commission to try to choose one habitat for another. We know that the scientists, as far as we're here, and the scientists that you have, they could debate that all day. And we can understand the reluctance that you might have to approve a project that has impacts on, honestly, a significant amount of SAV. But we don't see this as precedent setting. We see this as a very unique circumstance. We are the National Park Service. We are here trying to restore a marsh, a rapidly eroding, diminishing ecological resource. In addition, we have a congressional mandate telling us to do this. We have done thorough studies. We've gone through an entire EIS process. And to be honest, we've scaled back the project quite a lot from what was imagined in the EIS. What's more, the project has broad public support from the local community, as well as from elected federal, state, and local officials. I think you have a stack of letters in your submission materials from a lot of those folks. As I mentioned, we are dedicated to the success of this project. We have a great contractor on board, and we have money to take care of this project and make sure that it is a success. I think that we have done our best to demonstrate that we are willing to listen to the concerns of the Commission and trying to incorporate those as best we can. And as I've said, a lot of public money has already been spent on this project, and there's another $23 million worth of public money that is at risk if the project does not go forward, which really, frankly, should it not go forward, is probably the last chance we have to save Dyke Marsh. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions by members of the Commission? I'm sure there are. Going down, it's Ms. Everett.
Do you have two questions? That would be okay.
Yes, sir. Oh, yes, ma'am. Please.
So you had mentioned that the underwater grasses don't support plant or animal species on the land in your briefing, but just want to reconcile that. The Department of Game and Inland Fisheries wrote a letter on January 3rd, and then there's the VIMS letter on December 1st, which refer to the value of underwater grasses, acknowledging hydrilla is a primary component of this bed, for wildlife species. So I just didn't understand what you were intending to say versus those two statements.
Well, but we're not, but we're talking about the fact that it's not providing nearly as much benefit to the terrestrial species. So it's not providing the benefit to the mammals, to the birds, scientists that we talk to say that the marshland is ecologically a much more diverse community than SAB.
Okay, and is that substantiated somewhere
in the letters that are in there? We have letters from Katia Engelhart, from Ron Whitman, and from John Masden that talk about that. Talk about that in their experience in Dyke Marsh, and these scientists had actually studied Dyke Marsh specifically, and they are pointing out to us that although in other locations hydrilla has been shown to be able to support other native grasses, that in Dyke Marsh that does not seem to be the case.
And Commissioner,
yes, ma'am. Follow up.
Thank you. The second question I had, it might be a little bit out of our territory, but you had referred to the Nationwide 27 and how you had agreed to some mitigation, or there was a mitigation agreement. But my understanding of the Army Corps of Engineers permitting process in the Regulatory Division is avoidance first, then mitigation.
Sure.
So not mitigation because there was an agreement or proposal for the sake of mitigation. Can you speak to that?
And from our perspective, we were originally proposing 150 acres of restoration. Then it got down to 40. And then as sadly as it dwindled down to five and a half, basically. We felt as though we really were reducing the amount of impact to SAV. And a lot of it just, you know, could not be avoided, that, you know, particularly for the elements that are going, that we need to preserve the marsh, the promontory, and for the beach sills that would be going around the restoration area. You know, those are needed to be able to preserve the existing marsh. And from our perspective, the restored marsh, we believe, is equal, if not greater, to the ecological value of the SAV that is being displaced.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Further questions? Dr. Neal.
And again, I have a couple also. The our staff recommendation is for a lesser project. And what I just heard you say now is that if we denied your application, approved this lesser thing, that we're really scrapping the whole thing. That's your statement at this point. All right. The other thing is we have, under our recommendation, should the commission choose to approve this project, your proposal, they recommend these following conditions. And some of these you addressed. Time of year restrictions for Andromeda species and submittal of a mitigation plan review. Are these things that you would be comfortable with?
Absolutely they are, and in fact we are also comfortable with the time of year restrictions.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else here in support of this project wish to speak?
Just a member of the public.
Okay. That's fine. Who wishes to speak? If you would stand. It doesn't matter whether you're a member of the public. This is time for anyone who's in favor of this to speak. Okay, just one at a time. If each one is going to speak, stand, please. Stand up, please.
Swear you all live.
Swear you in at the same time. Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony that you'll give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you very much. Ma'am? Please proceed and state your name for the record.
My name is Glenda Booth. I'm sorry. My name is Glenda Booth. I'm president of the Friends of Dyke Marsh. First of all, Chairman Bowman, congratulations on your position.
Thank you, ma'am.
We look forward to working with you. And I want to publicly thank the VMRC staff and the VIM staff. I was on the Fairfax County Wetlands Board for 28 years, and for about 20 of those years, I chaired that board. And during those years, the VMRC staff and the VIM staff were very, very helpful, and we really couldn't have functioned without their input and their expertise. And so I just wanted to publicly thank all of them for their help over the years.
We appreciate that, ma'am. Thank you.
So the Friends of Dyke Marsh is a nonprofit volunteer conservation group. We were formed in 1976 because, as someone said, members of the community were concerned about the stability and the future of this freshwater tidal wetland. And so we have advocated for the conservation, protection, and restoration of Dyke Marsh for 42 years. I want to remind you of the National Park Service's mission because our previous speaker didn't actually mention that. But they are charged by Congress with managing the natural and historic objects of the United States and the wildlife therein by such means that will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. Dyke Marsh, as you've heard, is not only impaired, it is disappearing. And the U.S. Geological Survey, in their 2010 study and their 2013 update, reported that without stabilization, without action, Dyke Marsh will be completely gone by 2035. And they reported that it is in its late stages of failure and that it is in a stage of net erosion and that it's erosion and fragmentation will occur by 2035, which is not that far away. And others have explained, as USGS confirmed, that the dredging that took place from 1940 to 1972 fundamentally destabilized the entire system. And that USGS study is the basis, I believe, for the plan that you're hearing about today. A little bit of history. In 2004, the National Park Service hosted a kickoff meeting for Dyke Marsh Restoration, 14 years ago. And present at that meeting were VIMS, DGIF, National Park Service representatives, several academic wetland scientists, and the Friends of Dyke Marsh. And that work group concluded that Dyke Marsh restoration was both feasible and desirable, and hence the Park Service proceeded to develop a plan. As a previous speaker mentioned, the Congress has directed the Park Service to undertake restoration as early as 1959, when Congress added Dyke Marsh to the National Park Service system, and in several other times as well. And the Virginia General Assembly enunciated their support in a resolution that both houses passed in 2016. And to get to this point, the Park Service has already spent around $3.8 million on scientific studies, engineering plans, public meetings. This is the environmental impact statement. This reflects the serious work that has gone into preparing this plan. And fortunately, the Congress approved the Hurricane Sandy funding, and the Park Service successfully competed for a grant. And so, unlike many projects I work on, there's actual funding for this project. It's almost, I think, $28 million. The bulk of that is the grant of $24.9 million. But our previous speaker mentioned, this project has broad public support in our community. I have lived in this area since the early 70s. And the Mount Vernon Council of Citizen Associations, which represents all the communities in the immediate area, has endorsed this project at least three times. I have given you a list of elected officials that support this project, including our two Virginia U.S. senators, three members of Congress, many members of the Virginia State Senate and the House of Delegates, the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors, the Fairfax County Wetlands Board, the Alexandria City Council, and others that you will see on that list. You have received supportive letters from the Interstate Commission on the Potomac River Basin, from the National Parks Conservation Association, from many other groups. I won't list them all, but including Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens, the home of George Washington, George Washington's historic home, and Martha. In terms of your decision-making, I have been in your position many times, having served on the Wetlands Board, and I know there are many factors that you have to weigh, but I know that part of your mandate is the Virginia Constitution and the commitment to protect our natural resources, your obligations under Title 28, which include the preservation of wetlands and other factors, and your Chesapeake Bay obligation, Chesapeake Bay Agreement obligations, which do, of course, include preserving SAV, which is, by the way, not specific in terms of native and non-native, but I know that that is a commitment. But under the Chesapeake Bay Agreement, you're also obligated to preserve and restore wetland habitats. So we believe that this project, which has been thoroughly studied and vetted including with you and your staff, would help you fulfill those commitments. Oh, where's my photo? Oh, here it is. We brought you this photo. This is a very beautiful part of Dyke Marsh, and we believe that this represents what a restored Dyke Marsh could be. And so just to reiterate, we believe that Congress has directed the Park Service to do this. The funds are available for restoration, and there is strong support among elected officials and among our immediate community. And I want to just end on a personal note. I actually grew up in Southwest Virginia, and when I was a young girl, my father would load us up in the car every June and take us to Deltaville to go fishing. And we would spend several days out on the water fishing, and we would do that every year. And we would leave Southwest Virginia in the early morning hours when it was dark. And I remember waking up, and then suddenly there was the Chesapeake Bay and these beautiful marshes and the shimmering grasses and reeds of those marshes, and they made a real impact on me. And I think my father, who did not have an education, but he understood the ecological value of those marshes and their role. And I think he taught me that, yes, Glenda, this is where the fish start. And so there was something about that experience that stuck with me. And many of you live in the Tidewater and on the Eastern Shore, and you have beautiful marshes, and I know that you value them. Well, we want our marsh restored, and we want it back. And we think it can look like this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Anyone else? And as a matter of time, if we would, please do not be repetitive if you can avoid that. And
my remarks. May I hand
it? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure if this is
bad. We weren't going to put a timer on, but at the present time, the way things are going, we may have to limit it to 3 minutes per speaker.
Okay. I'll do my best, and you can tell me. Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Bowman, and each member of the VMRC and the staff for this opportunity. I'm surprised to be here, not just because of our two postponements, but because it seems that the bottom line is that we are debating the loss of several acres of hydrilla as compared to preventing a freshwater tidal marsh from disappearing. So you've already heard Mr. Jacobs and Glenda, Ms. Booth, talk about how it's disappearing. It's expected to be gone by 2035. This expected disappearance is in keeping with larger trends. 64% of the world's wetlands have disappeared since 1900, according to the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands. Since colonial times, the contiguous U.S. has lost more than half of its wetlands, which dropped from 221 million acres in the early 1600s to just over 110 million acres in 2009. In Virginia, around 40 to 45% of wetlands vanished during that same period. Coastal wetlands in the eastern U.S., like Dyke Marsh, are being lost at twice the rate they are being restored. And more than 80,000 acres of coastal wetlands are being lost on average each year. One last statistic, between the 4.5-year period from 2004 to 2009, wetlands in the Atlantic coastal watershed, of which we are a part, declined by an estimated 111,960 acres. And the loss of wetlands is significant because of the ecological services they provide. As Mr. Jacobs mentioned, freshwater tidal wetlands are known for high species diversity and extremely productive habitats. One VIM scientist calls them biological supermarkets. They provide nursery and forage grounds for pelagic fish. They provide important habitat for anadromous fish such as striped bass and American shad, as well as the Atlantic sturgeon. They offer an ideal food source for migratory shorebirds due to the exceptional high density and diversity of nutrient-rich marsh vegetation. Wetlands help purify water by trapping sediments and other pollutants, It's been estimated that a high-quality wetland can remove more than 90% of the nitrogen and phosphorus contained in stormwater runoff. Wetlands also serve as a storm buffer and absorb floodwaters. Storms and floods account for almost three-quarters of weather-related disasters and are becoming more common and more costly. 2017 was the most expensive year on record for natural catastrophes in the U.S., and storms and floods are increasing, populations are also increasing in size and moving to coastlines. Fairfax County, adjacent to the marsh, expects its own population to increase about 30% over the next 28 years. In other words, the need for the marsh to serve as a coastal buffer and shoreline protection is increasing. An acre of wetland can store 1 to 1.5 million gallons of flood water. Wetlands provide temporary storage of the floodwaters, releasing them slowly and reducing peak downstream flows. And one final point, declines in waterfowl populations along the Atlantic Flyway have been linked in part to declines in marsh acreage. What will be the effect on migratory birds like these red-breasted mergansers if the marsh disappears as it is on track to do by 2035? So to summarize, tidal freshwater wetlands are rare, declining, and significant. Unlike hydrilla, the preserve contains about 319 acres of SAV, predominantly hydrilla. The restoration project proposed in this application will result in a, quote, permanent loss of about 7 acres of invasive SAV. Dr. Linda Nelson of the Army Corps, whose PhD is in botany and weed science, stated in her January 17 comment letter that the perils of hydrilla were largely understated by VIMS and NOAA and MFS. Hydrilla has been classified, we already heard, as a federal noxious weed. It's also been recognized and regulated as an invasive noxious weed by many states, and the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation puts hydrilla on the Virginia Invasive Plant Species List and designates it as a species that exhibits high levels of invasiveness. It has a prolific growth rate with multiple reproductive strategies, colonizing large areas in a relatively short time. So, for example, a single 4-inch stem of hydrilla can grow vertically and horizontally up to 191 inches per day. So my arm span is about 67 inches. That's about a third of the maximum daily growth rate of hydrilla. This summer, I was kayaking in the Potomac River and saw for myself large, dense hydrilla patches that I could not avoid and had to be ever so careful to keep my paddles clear of the branches that were like greedy, sticky hands. Studies have found that high densities of hydrilla can adversely affect the growth of fish species by reducing foraging success, bluegill, for example, and reducing predator-prey interactions between largemouth bass and bluegill. And high densities represent a risk to fish populations due to depleted oxygen levels. Hydrilla creates AVM, a fatal neurological disease of the southeastern U.S. that has killed many birds, including ducks and geese. But I'll defer to Dr. Nelson's letter on that point. She goes into detail about AVM, which has not been sampled for in the Potomac River, but has been found in Virginia. The type of hydrilla found in the preserve was first identified there in 1982. And in 4 years became the most abundant species in the area. In other words, hydrilla is abundant, aggressive, adaptable, and thriving. Dr. Katarina Engelhart, longtime researcher of the preserve, is, quote, baffled by the VIMS argument comparing the potential loss of several acres of hydrilla to the potential gain of tidal marsh wetland. VIMS acknowledges in its December 1 comment letter, we recognize that ongoing erosion at the preserve poses a real and significant environmental problem. Dr. George Ledeck, ecologist, in his comment letter to VMRC said that in Dyke Marsh, the tidal freshwater wetland marsh stands out as a higher value ecosystem than its SAV. The Friends of Dyke Marsh believe that VMRC should recognize the value of a healthy, functioning, biodiverse marsh, all of the aquatic and terrestrial species, and not just invasive hydrilla beds. The proposed restoration of the marsh is funded, designed, contracted out. How likely will Congress be to fund a similar project before 2035 if we can't get this done? If this restoration doesn't happen, the marsh is likely doomed. I encourage you to vote yes without conditions on the permit application to restore the preserve. Thank you for your public service.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions? Thank you, ma'am. Who's next?
Good morning, Chairman Bowman and members of the commission.
Ma'am, could you state your name for the record, please?
Jessica Strother.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, Chairman Bowman and members of the commission. My name is Jessica Strother, and I'm a longtime resident of Arlington County, Virginia. I'm here to testify in support of the restoration proposal for Dyke Marsh by the National Park Service. Earlier, I submitted a paper to the Commission dated February 20th, 2018, that dealt with the criticality of reversing impacts to the marsh from unnatural erosion, the effort to preserve significant wildlife and fisheries, impacts from pollution, and the need to establish areas of emergent wetlands and marshland, as well as reviewing the negative impacts from hydrilla and invasive SAV. All this is in an effort to discuss the need for restoration and stewardship of the marsh. The funds to do the restoration have been appropriated by Congress, as you know, and come with a responsibility to restore Dyke Marsh. Since childhood, I've spent a lot of time along the banks of the Potomac River and near Washington, D.C., fishing, observing wildlife, kayaking, and exploring the marsh. I've observed changes in the marsh over the years, most notably when I've kayaked in the tidal section of the marsh and observed extensive erosion. I've also observed almost the total lack today of the marsh wren, an iconic species there that at one time was there by the hundreds. Some of us believe that a combination of toxins in the river and unnatural wave action and erosion have eliminated the bird's prey base. At one time, the marsh was 380 acres, and today it is now approximately 50, excluding the western section that is 15 to 20 acres. It is my understanding that the National Park Service, in conversations with officials from the state of Virginia, have proposed a number of changes and revisions in the application and engineering design to address various concerns. This has all been done in good faith. Your approval of the permit and proposal is requested in light of all the meetings, papers, correspondence, surveys, engineering plans, and scientific studies that have been conducted on many fronts to get to this point. Thank you for your consideration with this important issue and proposal, and thank you for your work on behalf of the citizens of the Commonwealth.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Any questions? Again, we thank you. Who's next? Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Larry Zaragoza. I live in the area I live in the general vicinity. I want to talk about a couple different things here. One is there was a fairly rigorous process for the development of an EIS. That process involved bringing in a number of different experts and so forth, getting review, getting comment. The same kind of process did not occur for many of the criticisms that have been levied about Dyke Marsh. One of the things, as a professional, I work for an environmental agency, and one of the things I know is scientists often disagree. And that's healthy, and that's how science evolves. But what I see before you today is a very difficult situation because you have disagreeing scientists, and in order to resolve that, what you really need to do is you need to have peer review, and you need to have further studies and other things like that. This very much seems like an unresolved issue. That is the question of the trade-off between hydrilla and reconstruction of marshland. It is not a simple thing. It seems to me that the conclusions I hear from VIMS are basically that it's not possible for the Park Service to show that the benefits of restoring the marsh would outweigh the damages to the hydrilla. You can flip that around, and I think it would be very, very difficult to prove the other side. I'm saying that this whole issue is largely uncertain and unresolved. I also want to say that I think the process that was initially proposed by the Park Service was great. We have seen across the country that people have taken dredge material and used it to restore marshes. And we've rebuilt wetlands all across the country. And what they have proposed to do is take the dredge material, put it into the marsh in order to rebuild, put a cap on it, and that would be the way they do it. that works out well for a lot of different parties, because one of the other things it does is it helps to restore waterways so they can be boatable for recreational activities. If you don't end up doing something like a beneficial use where you're using it to restore marshes, what you're doing is you're taking this stuff to a landfill, or you're maybe putting just open dumping or something else like that, which I think are both hideous alternatives. And I think that is something that I think would be good to consider, because the original proposal by the Park Service, I think, was the right one. I very much think that this is the Park Service proposal is the right thing to do. It frustrates me that a lot of these comments seem to have come in late and very difficult to resolve, because there's not an open process for a scientific resolution of some of these things. And the fact is, I think if there was such a process, it would be uncertain. I also want to note that I live in a community that is on the waterfront. Both our Homes Association and the Marine Association have gone on record, as one of the letters you have in your file, along with my comments, saying that they would like to dispose of the dredge material that we have when we dredge in Dyke Marsh. Of course, when you take the materials and you test them to ensure they would be okay for use in such a process, they should be absolutely fine. I also want to say that I'm very, very frustrated with the use of the term clean fill material, because the Corps of Engineers and the Park Service work together, and they've established criteria. The Corps of Engineers, I guess, has the criteria. And basically what they say is, in order to use fill material, it has to pass all these tests. They evaluate it chemical by chemical, and they say it's okay or it's not okay. They label clean as for sand or other things, but they seem to have a bias against dredge material as though it is dirty, which makes absolutely no sense at all, and it runs contrary to what the rest of the country is doing. So I wanted to raise all these points to you. Obviously, I feel some level of frustration with the process, because I think this provides a real opportunity to bring together a better process for finding a beneficial use for dredge spoils. It provides an opportunity to benefit those who want to dredge canals and so forth, and it provides an opportunity to safely rebuild the marsh. And I think all those things should be considered. I think right now everything is at risk, and I think that is unfortunate. I really hope the project can go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else wish to speak on behalf? Is there anyone opposed to this issue present? Okay, what we're going to do is we've been going at this about 2 hours and 10 minutes, 20 minutes. We're going to take about a 10-minute break. We're going to then come back, hear staff's recommendations. Mr. Neal, as you had requested from a delineation perspective, I'd like to also hear just a little bit more from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, because as we've gone through these discussions, we've heard about the charge from Congress, the charge certain mandates, but we also have a charge here, 228.2-1205, that we are also obligated to follow. So with that, we're going to take about a 10-minute break. For the benefit of the audience, after we handle this case, we will be breaking for lunch. Well, we will then take up the remainder of the agenda after lunch. So just to give you a heads up, I'm not sure exactly how long this is going to take to complete, but in case you want to make plans, you can plan on being back here, I would say, around 1 o'clock or so. Okay, so we're going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and hear the remainder of the case. We're back in session. Once again, is there anyone in opposition to this project? Seeing none, at this time, I would like to call representatives from VIMS, based on the fact, as we indicated, pursuant to 28.2-1205, that deals with the requirement to consider subaqueous vegetation as part of our deliberative process. I'd like to call a representative from BIMS, whoever that may ultimately be, Dr. Luckenbach. You've been previously sworn, sir. State your name for the record, please.
Mark Luckenbach.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner and Commission members. I'm up here mostly to tell you that we're not to say a whole lot, but to say that we're here to answer your questions. And after I've said a few words, I'm going to bring Lyle Varnell up. A few direct questions to him about any of the topics that you've heard, species composition of the SAV, dike marsh, construction, et cetera. We'll bring up the people that are our experts. But I want to speak to something just a little bit more generically. And first begin by saying we take very, very seriously the loss of the marsh, the tidal freshwater marsh at Dyke Marsh, and the ecosystem services that go with it. Protecting that and other marshes like it are important. Any of you who have been on the commission for a while have received numerous VIMS comments that seek to minimize impact to marshlands. We've got a true expert on tidal freshwater marshes here in Jim Perry. And so we take it really seriously. We don't want to see nothing done. In fact, more generically, as we begin to lose marshes and more marshes in Virginia waters, we need to come at this with some clear-eyed vision about what we're going to do and how we're going to protect them and what's the way forward. Honestly, in 1959, one of the early states we saw, or in 1974, I think we'd have all been excited about building out a marsh. I don't think there would have been any opposition to it. But in times with, you know, now sea level rise is accelerating, our approach to maintaining, protecting, and continuing to have healthy marshes can't be to look waterward and to fill subaqueous bottoms, vegetated or unvegetated. The forward-looking thing in this is to look backwards, to look up, and protect what we've got. We're going to need to do that in a lot of places, and look more to the uplands. And none of that's ever going to be easy. There's always structures. I think it's unfortunate that we've got to sort of the 11th hour and 59 minute here before spending this money, because I think $25 million could have gone a long way towards being forward-looking rather than backwards-looking. How we protect this marsh and set an example for others in the future. So that doesn't make your decision here about this easier today, but we really want to look towards 21st century methods that are going to work and not backwards to the middle of the last century. So with that, unless anybody has, if you really want to hear from the experts, they're standing behind me.
Mr. Ballard.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on sea level rise and what your thoughts are? And I'd like to hear a little bit of, not an actual plan or detail, but just a little bit more elaboration on what kind of alternatives you would have done to protect this area that are more forward-thinking like you're suggesting.
Well, first of all, marshes, at the current rate of sea level rise, many of our marshes can keep up. It depends upon sediment supply and their growth rates. Okay, and we have others in the room as well that have more knowledge about that than I do. Again, Dr. Perry. But we also know as sea level rise rates increase, you reach thresholds where, depending on the amount of sediment that's also being delivered to marshes, that you just start to see drowned marshes. And you're familiar with places where there are drowned marshes on the eastern shore. Some of the marshes are growing and rolling back, and some are moving up into the uplands. I know you've seen that on the seaside of the eastern shore. So we really believe that it's important to protect that marsh. The alternative plan that has less impacts that staff recommended to you, that I believe staff is going to talk to you about more, does bring out and build some marsh. It's actually a large living shoreline. I mean, you know, when you build a living shoreline out, in many cases, you've built some marsh on subaqueous bottom. But it's no attempt to reclaim 200 plus feet out in the narrowest area. Then the general approach, where possible, And it's almost always going to involve structures, some structures at risk, is to allow areas to or marshes to gradually, slowly build towards the uplands as sea level rises. And the exactly what the options might have been for the Park Service there, I don't know. But the alternative plan, nobody's proposed not doing it. The alternative plan that put forth by staff is, in fact, to provide what we think would be very good protection for that marsh and for the forested section that's there. I agree completely with the last speaker that nobody's saying SAB is more valuable than marsh here. In fact, I think our report concludes, or our report to you concludes that. Talks about benefits of both, and that it's not really able to make a judgment. Just losing more and more.
Further questions? Yes, sir, Mr. Ballard.
There was one support letter I thought was particularly insightful, but raised the point that your calculation of losing more SAV than marsh lost. Or losing 7 acres of SAV to gain 5 acres of marsh, and looking at it from that, ignores the fact that if nothing is done, you'll lose a lot more acres of marsh. So you might look at it as losing 5 acres of SAV or 7 acres of SAV, but eventually losing 40 acres of marsh. How do you feel about that?
I agree with that completely. We agree completely that the marsh needs to be protected, and don't recommend something that leaves it unprotected.
Further question, Ms. Everett.
I'm not sure if this is for VIMS or for staff or potentially both, but how would you respond to the applicant's comments that it's their original proposal or nothing? Their times run out. You'd have to go back and revisit everything, and contracts would be void.
I'm going to turn that to the university staff. Yes.
Yeah, I'll comment on that, and certainly I don't want to dispute the comments you heard from Doug today regarding his perspective on the funding and what might happen, but I will characterize the meeting on the March 9th that was facilitated by the Secretary of Natural Resources Office to see if we could come to some common ground between SAV loss and marsh creation here. There were two funding components articulated during that meeting. One being the funding, or it wasn't necessarily two funding components, but maybe two contracting components with the funds. One being the contract for the dike, which is pretty much set, and that's the breakwater feature, the long 1,500 linear foot feature that attaches to the land and extends offshore. And then there was the component that was the marsh creation, which was a bit of a different contracting component. And we were of the impression that funding was in jeopardy for the offshore breakwater component. If that didn't go through, then everything might fall apart, and that's why we recommended that you consider that as part of your motion and allow that to move forward immediately if it's approved, but that there could be some contracting consideration for a change in the marsh configuration, and that could then be accommodated through the contracting and use of the fundings as that's basically redesigned. So to me, that's the characterization that we received during the meeting on the 9th. That there was some ability to go with the phase of the breakwater, but that the contracting could accommodate some changes to the marsh design. And
just a second. Further follow up from Mr. Watkinson?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Sir, yes, sir. This is a little out of order from normal hearings that we have, but I want to get the best information possible out there for the commission to be able to hear to make a decision. So I apologize for the little bit of askewness, for lack of a better term, of the way this hearing is going, but I'd rather have the information out than not. So, sir, please proceed.
Yeah, the contract, the entire contract has been awarded. The portion for the breakwater, is as designed. What we did for the portion of the restoration area is that we awarded it, but we awarded it with unit prices, so that if there was a little bit of massaging here and there, and as long as the fundamental details of how that was built were the same, we would be able to sort of move and shape the contour itself. So that was the flexibility that we were talking about. I think that after that meeting, we came away, however, realizing that that what was being proposed was a reduction from the 5.5 acres down to only about an acre and a half. And at that point, there were two things that we were concerned, well, actually several things we were concerned about. One was this cardinal change, that was so significant to the scope that therefore we might have to recompete the project. And the fact that the nationwide 27 permit had been based upon the idea that we would be restoring marsh, and that was going to be the mitigation for the impacts to SAV. When in that meeting, we had talked about as much as 3 to 4 acres, and we had sort of talked to the regulatory people in Norfolk at the Army Corps of Engineers, and when we were saying 3 to 4 acres, they were saying, maybe we could make that work. But we were all understanding that as 3 to 4 acres of restoration. And as we came back around and got the specifics and exchanged the notes of our understanding of the meeting, really what they were talking about was 3 to 4 acres, including future work to stabilize along the parkway, to stabilize further along the north of the marsh, and that really the project that we were looking at today and what they were recommending going forward with would only amount to about an acre and a half. And so that was not enough in the Corps' estimation to be enough mitigation to compensate for the loss of SAV.
Further questions? I was not there at the March 9th meeting for obvious reasons. During the course of that discussion, initially it was brought up that Park Service had agreed to enter in a cooperative agreement as far as the SAV restoration monitoring program to the tune of $400,000. Yes. That's still the intent.
We want to be good partners.
I believe that. I just want to make sure because I just want to make sure.
Yeah, we are committed to that even if you deny the project. And well, I just, doesn't happen, but, you know, we...
All good. Just want to make sure. Okay. Any further follow-up to my inquiry from VIMS pertaining to SAV and the importance or lack thereof for this project? Mr. Ballard.
This probably VIMS might be staff as well, but can someone educate me on the SAV goal we often hear about? And
that would be VIMS, sir, in all due respect. Dr. Orth. And for the record, because just real quick, the Mark Luckenbach, your title is
Associate Dean of Research and Advisory Service
for the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And the reason I say that is because the code requires us to consult VIMS on these matters, and Dr. Luckenbach is a member of VIMS, for the record. Dr. Orth, also a member of VIMS.
Yes, sir. Chesapeake Bay has broken the bay and all tributaries into segments. Each segment now has an SAV restoration goal and a water clarity goal. These goals were set based on, for SAV, historic coverages of what was there either in the recent past or historic past. So, for example, in the Potomac River, there are a variety of segments. There's a tidal freshwater, an oligohaline, a mesohaline, and a polyhaline based because it's a long river with different salinities. So that tidal freshwater area has a target, and that target has been met, but it fluctuates over time. So over the course of the years that we've been monitoring SAV from our aerial imagery, which is what is used as a measure of meeting the target, prior to about 2009, we had not met the target, but since then we've been meeting the target for SAV coverage in the tidal freshwater areas of the Potomac.
Mr. Ballard?
And that target was established by the Chesapeake Bay Act, is that?
Well, the Chesapeake Bay program itself challenged the community because historically there was a number that was thrown out that was not based on good science. So they came back and said, okay, let's see where SAB occurred so we have realistic numbers that we can have as a target that's that can be attained. And so that's why we went back, and Dr. Moore was in charge of a lot of the studies that looked at the historic coverages using old aerial imagery as well as the current imagery that we get, and then that target was based on the single best year of SAV in that particular area. So in some cases where we had very little SAV, the target was low, and now in some cases we've exceeded it because we've seen this recovery of SAV. In areas where we've had great historic coverages, the goal is really high and maybe very difficult to meet. So, again, this is something that, again, as I said in the paper, this is a project that's got to continue because, again, there's a restoration goal for the whole bay of around 180,000 acres right now. And so we're, as of 1696, and, well, in the afternoon you'll hear my presentation, but we're probably going to break 100,000 acres for the first time ever in the course of the survey for 2017. But, again, getting to your question, every single bay segment, and there's 97 of them, have a restoration target for SAV based on what I just commented on.
Further questions of Dr. Orth? Thank you, sir. Yes, sir, you had your hand up.
Well, I'm Ken Moore. I'm the scientist again.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to add that while there's an SAV goal, there is a water clarity standard.
Can you move a little bit closer to the podium so we can get on the record? Thank you.
So there's a water clarity standard, much like we have dissolved oxygen standards, low dissolved oxygen in regions, is water clarity standard. And what was set up with that is you can meet the water clarity standard if you meet the SAB goal. Okay. So because SAB are the important designated use related to water clarity and because of how they support the habitat. So for each segment, not only do we have specific acreages for SAV, and we have for the bay, and if you meet those, then you meet the standard connected to clean water. Both Virginia and Maryland have them. So that's in State Water Control Board passed that. And so it's beyond just simply we have a goal, we want to get them back. Now we have specific numeric standards. So that's why when you're in a small creek on the Eastern Shore, and there's a loss, it's very important because then that segment of the bay can be meet this Clean Water Act goal, which of course can then affect the TMDLs for that area and a variety of other things. So that's just wanted to show that, so the SAV acreage is very important. And it was also when it was designed or set up, that was really forward thinking to say, if you meet the designated use, you also meet the standard, right? So if you have fish in the river meeting certain levels that you want, then it might meet some other water constituent standard. And it says it's met it because you've met the designated use. So that's really forward thinking to the bay, and that came between the states, Virginia and Maryland. And so that's why these numbers are that Bob Orth and his group maps every year are so important because they go meeting a standard for the bay.
Thank you, sir.
Sorry.
I just stand up here. I want to make sure we answer your question rather than sort of come up and give you questions.
That's okay. Any further questions from Vince? Ms. Everett?
If it hasn't really been covered to the extent necessary, could Vince potentially speak to what's referenced in your letters, the land, that this is a land reclamation versus a marsh restoration effort or project?
Well, I guess I can start. We can call on others. Like we say in our report, the term restoration means using an existing substrate to do this. It's. I guess if I had a picture of a table from colonial times and went and rebuilt that table, I cannot say I restored that table. And this is what this is. Now, restoration in the classic
ecological sense, and I do think it would be constructive to hear from Dr. Perry because he was a he was truly a pioneer in tidal freshwater restorations. Much of the ecosystem function you get from a wetland is in the mature soils and sediments of that. That's not the sand or the dredge spoil. It has to be developed over time. Much of the peer review that's been done by us and others, and much that's in your report that we reference, is just that. It just shows that there that even in the best case scenario, it takes time to develop these ecosystem functions that marshes provide. And that is somewhat, in most cases, if not the majority of the cases, accelerated when it's a true restoration of a relic marsh than a creation from essentially from scratch is what we have here. So anything else that Dr. Perry would do?
State your name for the record, please, and who?
James Perry.
And you're with?
Dems.
Thank you.
Your question was restoration versus creation. Is that correct?
In the VIMS letter on the third page, that it refers to the proposed project being more appropriately termed potentially land reclamation, according to VIMS, versus marsh restoration. And I believe that might be echoed in the DGIF letter, but I haven't substantiated that.
Well, creation to us is when you take a habitat and change it into a different habitat from a wetland, and in most cases it's from a dry land to a wetland. Okay. And I think in this case what they're looking at is they're looking at something as a SAV process and turning it into a wetland, which would not be a restoration of the marsh, but a creation of a different type of habitat. That make sense to you? In other words, you know, they're claiming it was a marsh 50 years ago, but the natural processes have really changed that. So now it's actually going to be more of almost a reclamation of the land, reclaiming of the land, turn it back into a marsh.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, sir. Further questions pertaining to? Okay. What we'll do now is, Mr. Watkinson, what I'd like to have is the clarification of the staff recommendations at this time, please, for the commission and for the benefit of the applicant.
I ask you to bear with me for just a second as I sort of read through this. As we've attempted to do in our staff evaluation from the original evaluation that was for the first two meetings that were tabled to the addendum that was prepared for you as a result of the meeting that was facilitated by the Secretary of Natural Resources, it's staff's recommendation that the commission approved the alternative plan. Would say with that we have not taken a position on the breakwater part and where it connects to land, recognizing the sensitivity of the funding that's necessary for that to go forward. So if that's part of the alternative plan, then we have a permanent SAV loss, we think, of about estimated 1.7 acres. And that includes the breakwater at 0.5 acres. However, the final amount of that would be based on the revised drawings that would be necessary if the alternative plan is approved. The wetlands created from that alternative plan, based on the National Park Service estimates, would be about 1.5 acres of wetlands that could be created in that area. And again, that final amount would be based on the final revised drawings. And it would be staff's recommendation that if we go with the alternative plan, that once we know the final amount of SAV impacted, that the cooperative effort from the Park Service and working with the MRC should be funded at an amount of $2 per square foot for that area of SAV loss. So staff recommends that the commission approve the alternative plan. The project would consist of locating the revised wetland creation boundary at half the distance to the narrowest proposed offshore boundary, beginning at the northern terminus of the wetland creation area and extending south to terminate at the southern natural shoreline of the same wetland creation area. This portion of the project is intended to create a linear marsh fringe along the forested wetland shoreline that would extend approximately 100 feet channelward of the existing stands of SAV, or should say into the existing stands of SAV. But with that area, the staff would recommend the following conditions as part of the alternative design: a time of year restriction preventing in-stream work between February 15 and June 30 of any year to protect anadromous fish species. The permittee shall submit detailed drawings for VMRC staff review and approval of the redesigned wetland creation area. The previously offered modifications that we had in our original evaluation would include the deletion of the proposed fill of the deep scar area, and that's been done. The incorporation of larger stone in the cobble beach sills. The creation of gaps or access routes to allow for the free movement of aquatic fauna. And the use of only clean sand fill from upland locations composed of no less than 90% sand should be incorporated into the redesigned drawings for the substrate to fill for the wetland creation. The permittee shall develop and submit a plan for VMRC staff approval to restore the contours of any state-owned submerged land to original contours should mud waves result from the construction of the project. And finally, the permit shall submit a plan for use of any collaborative funding at $2 per square foot for SAV loss for review and approval by VMRC staff. The plan may consist of replanting of SAV, contributions to ongoing efforts supporting SAV restoration and management, a combination of the two, or another strategy acceptable to VMRC staff. No work on the created wetland portions of the project authorized in the permit shall be started until a mitigation plan is approved by Commission staff. Work can commence on the stone breakwater portion of the project and can begin immediately following execution of the permit. And that would be staff's recommendation for the alternative design.
Any questions by members of the commission for Mr. Watkinson based on staff's recommendation? Dr. Neal.
And them was consulted with this plan?
March 9th meeting and recognized that this plan was a better alternative. It did not eliminate all the SAV that would be impacted, but they did recognize that the marsh fringe that was being created was adjacent to a forested area and would be an important component of a living shoreline type design at that location. So without putting words in their mouth, I would say they felt this was the better design and agreed with it.
I see their heads are nodding. So,
as well as this, as well as the secretary's position as well.
That's correct.
Okay. Questions, Mr. Watkinson? Now, I'd like to hear from the applicant if he has any comment pertinent to that.
Well, as much as I appreciate that, I'm not convinced that the project can go forward that way. As I mentioned, it would be considered a cardinal change. We would probably have to throw out the existing project. Funding at that point would be at risk. And then, as I mentioned, when we talked about the Nationwide 27 permit, they were looking at this as requiring at least 3 to 4 acres of restoration to be able to compensate for the mitigation of wetlands. And so getting us down to 1.5 acres is going to throw us back into the permitting process. We don't have time for that. We will lose the money. And the idea that, you know, any leftover money could be used to stabilize other portions of the marsh, that's a really nice idea, but in all practicality, the money will disappear, and so it will not be available for us to do further stabilization along the parkway or further up the marsh. So we feel very strongly that we need to go forward with the entire project.
Thank you, sir. The matter is before the commission for discussion and ultimate action. Mr. Ballard.
I'll kick off the discussion. I'm rather torn here. A lot of issues that going on. You know, we have the loss of critical SAV that we deal with regularly. At the same time, the goal of the project seems to be a good one. I'm lamenting the fact that I think, I'm not sure exactly how long this has been in design works, but it seems to me that if we'd had a meeting of the minds between VIMS and possibly the folks designing the project earlier in this process, we could have avoided being here at the 12th hour. That being said, we are here and need to make a decision. I constantly talk here about SAV and conflicts we have with it, and sometimes it feels like we are prohibiting really, really good projects to save what folks describe as a few strands of grass in the water. At the same time, this tends to be an area that, as we've heard from Dr. Orth, is 100% coverage of SAV. It's different than the other projects we hear that are typically, we don't allow things to go on when it's 0 to 10% coverage at one time in the last 5 years. This is an established, very permanent bed of SAV. So a lot of conflicts here. It's a lot of money that could go to other projects. But I'm failing to see why it can't be accomplished in a more responsible manner. I look at it as, well, we might lose $25 billion, but, you know, if this can be done in a more responsible manner, isn't that the more appropriate thing to do? I think as of now I'm in favor of the compromise that's been proposed. Well, I won't call it a compromise, but the alternative that's been proposed by staff and is opposed to by the applicant.
Thank you. Ms. Lusk?
I first want to say that I appreciate the fact that, sort of all the discussions about this project are centered towards conservation. And it's awfully nice to be sitting here having a conversation about that compared to some of the other things that we've been talking about recently. I myself am also struggling with this sort of idea that one natural habitat has more value than the other. And in reading some of the reports and talking about the value of established habitat versus the time it takes for a restoration or reclamation project to sort of attain that same value. And I agree with Mr. Ballard in that, you know, I wish that we were not here at this point, but I'm not comfortable coming out with a decision that says we value one more than the other.
Thank you. Further discussion? Although coming in, as we said at the late hour, I agree with both of my colleagues on the commission. Very, very careful in asking the question pertaining to the value of hydrilla as an SAV species that provides benefit here. I also struggle with the fact that the creation of the project that the Park Service desired. It's, as Ms. Lusk said, it's agonizing, but it's also in one way very, very pleasant to hear that we do have two competing conservation projects. But at the same time, I've got to also defer to the code of Virginia that specifies it. As I said earlier, I want to make the decisions on the best science I have available. And the best science I have available is that of the experts of the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, which not just one, but a number of them have laid out indicating the value of this this bed of SAV. And we have done what the Code of Virginia has required, and that is considered pursuant to Section 6, submerged aquatic vegetation, and pursuant to Subsection B, consulted agencies such as the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. There's no further comment. I tend to support the comments made by my colleagues, and I support the not compromise, but staff's recommendation, because I do believe the meetings were held March 9th. There was some discussion. I think there was a heartfelt belief that upon departure that day that it was going to be a satisfactory remedy. Then, and as does happen, other folks may have been consulted or further deliberations, or as the gentleman noted, further notes were compared, and things changed after the meeting. So if it's a tie, I tend to vote for staff recommendation. Matters before the commission for action.
I'll move to
approve. Dr. Neal.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
I move to approve staff recommendation.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ballard. Further discussion by the commission. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed?
Opposed.
Opposed.
Motion carries with two opposition. Let the record reflect Mr. Minor and Mr. France opposed. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be taking a break for lunch. We'll return back here to continue the agenda at 1 o'clock. Thank you for the discussion.